today. Lives in Puyallup, but I believe he's unemployed. It just shows how bad we are. But David Hoover used to be a professor. With Clark at Covenant College, and he debated Clark back in the 80s, a few years before Clark died. He said that basically Clark, they questioned his salvation when he died, and he was very skeptical he's looking for absolute certainty. And he acts like he knows beyond a shadow of a doubt all this stuff, but then as time goes on, it's less and less and less. But here's what I wrote about Clark in Probabilistic Arguments. He gives no credit to probability arguments. That's the subheading. Clark points out that other systems of philosophy do not have a starting point based on certainty. They must presuppose their first principles. However, Clark's own first principles are not based on certainty. They too must be presupposed. Seems that Clark is judging his own philosophical system in a more lenient fashion than he does other schools of thought. It is true that Clark finds confirmation for the Christian presupposition that is lacking in other presuppositions. Still, this is after the fact. And as Clark admits, this confirmation itself only makes Christianity more probable than other views. It does not establish its certainty. It seems that more credit should be given to arguments for first principles based upon a high degree of probability. Why should an argument be rejected when its premises and conclusions are very probable while opposing views are unlikely?
That's funny. You oppose this probability, yet all it does is make Christianity the more probable choice.
Yeah, see, in his system of thought, he finds contradictions. It's like worldviews and religions and belief systems are like trees in a forest. He takes the law of non-contradiction, okay, his axe, Gordon Clark, and he chops down all the trees in the forest except for his own. And then he puts the axe over his shoulder and you say, well, Gordon Clark, how do you know Christianity is true? And he turns and looks at it and says, it's the only tree that's still standing, isn't it? So, as Gordon Lewis pointed out, it's always logically possible that somebody might prove a contradiction, an essential contradiction to Christianity. Logically possible. We know that's not going to happen. It's not actually possible because Christianity is true, but it's logically possible. That's number one. Number two, what if somebody plants a tree a few years from now that grows up without contradictions? So I mean, there's no way you could even know all the different views that are out there, let alone claim to have refuted them. So in the end, his apologetic system, Christianity has been proven true to a probable degree. Well, then why does he attack probability arguments? See, and then I put down here, other philosophers have settled for less than certainty, but still have solid systems of thought. Some might argue for premises that they believe are beyond all reasonable doubt. I mean, we execute guys based on reasoning beyond all reasonable doubt.
Right.
Norman Geisler, following in the tradition of Thomas Aquinas, uses the principle of actual undeniability, which is not logical necessity, but is about as close to it as you can get. Okay. Some things cannot be denied without contradiction and therefore must be true. For instance, if I deny my existence, I must first exist to make the denial. For nothing is nothing. Nothing cannot deny anything. Only an existent being can deny something. Therefore, it is actually undeniable that I exist. Charles Hodge based his philosophical arguments on what he believed were self-evident truths. Though these truths could be denied by others, their denial is forced and temporary. In other words, they just deny it just for purposes of the debate, but then they go, yeah, there's no such thing as non-physical entities and like moral laws and blah, blah, blah. And then they go home and they tell their wife they love her. Well, love is a non-physical entity, so it's a forced and temporary view. Once the philosopher finishes lecturing and debating, he returns to the real world and no longer denies self-evident truths, such as his existence, the existence of others, and the reality of moral values. He can deny moral values in the lecture hall, but once he is at home, he calls the police when he is robbed. It seems then that Clark is mistaken. Christians can discover truths that are either self-evident or actually undeniable. They can then dialogue with non-believers using these premises as common ground. Clark was wrong not to give proper due to first principles based upon a high degree of probability. This leaves the door open for traditional apologetics. So basically, I think his considering induction a fallacy and rejecting probabilistic arguments was itself problematic. Now, he also, you would think, well, then he's an ultra-rationalist. Yes and no. Yes, he really was heavy on rationalism, but only his kind of rationalism. It's problems with rationalism that, first, reason cannot prove everything. Okay? It can't prove its own first principles. Because if reason can prove your first principles, then there would be premises that lead to your first principles. But then your first principles wouldn't be your starting points. They wouldn't be your first principles. The premises would be. But if reason could prove everything, then reason could prove those premises. So you'd have premises before them. And it goes on and on. You'd have an infinite regress. Reason never gets started. So in pure rationalism, reason never gets started. So Clark says that something must be presupposed. And I agree with them on that point. The only problem is, I think Aquinas and Augustine, especially Augustine with his more rationalistic bent than empirical bent of Aquinas, I think Augustine and Aquinas are on firmer ground on this particular point than Clark, because they agree something must be presupposed. So they say, why not presuppose that which entails a contradiction in its denial? In other words, when you do take on like laws of logic, or you know, my existence, I can't prove that with logical necessity. At the same time, just the fact that I'm here to deny my existence must mean that I have to exist in order to make the denial. So I mean, there are starting points that seem to be self-evident or beyond reasonable doubt, or you have to use them just to think, like the law of non-contradiction. You have to presuppose the law of non-contradiction just to deny it. Because you see, if you say the law of non-contradiction is not true, if you're not presupposing the law of non-contradiction when you say that, you're saying then that it can both be, it is both true and not true. But you're not. You're saying that it's not true. So you're presupposing that the contrary of what you're saying is false. You're presupposing the same law you're trying to refute. And so I think we can find starting. We have to presuppose some starting points. Why not presuppose the starting points that are essential just for us to think and communicate? And Clark wouldn't have anything to do with that. He just arbitrarily presupposed the law of non-contradiction in the existence of the triune God of the Bible, who's revealed himself in the Bible. What were you going to say?
I was looking at an argument about truth and fact. Like the fact of the matter is, yeah, you exist, and you can believe that you deny yourself, that can be your truth, but the fact of the matter is, you exist, and therefore the facts knock down your truth. Like, you can say, you know, like kind of say, yeah, this, you know, this table is in my mind, it's not really here. The fact is, the table is here, just because you decide to believe it may not be there, that's your truth. But the facts shoot down your truth.
Well, I wouldn't even call it your truth, but it would be with people who define truth as something subjective, like the existentialists, rather than defining truth as whatever is objectively true, they would call it true. But I would say a person's subjective beliefs, if they do not correspond to objective reality, then their beliefs are false. And as far as facts and truth, there are several different theories as far as whether a truth or an idea is a fact, or a truth or a fact or an idea are propositions about facts. And it's a whole thing. I don't even know. I'm not even sure where I stand. But basically, yeah, there's got to be. And Clark would agree with that. Well, but where he tests, you know, first he's got to have logical necessity, and since you can't get it for starting points, he says, well, then you just have to dogmatically presuppose something. And everything that has been dogmatically presupposed always ends up in skepticism, one way or another. So I'm going to just presuppose that Christianity is true. And lo and behold, I find out it gives meaning to life, it makes sense of our moral experience. But that's not an argument with logical necessity. So therefore, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. All the slamming on the probabilistic arguments that he did. So in other words, I think he's got a good argumentation. Even Van Til and Clark were two presuppositionists who didn't agree on anything. But I think both of them had really strong arguments. The problem is they were both saying only my arguments work.
That sounds like
Gordon. Yeah. And so I've learned a lot from Gordon Clark, and I've learned a lot from Van Til. But the fact of the matter is, I can't call myself Clarkian or Van Tilian because I'm not Van Til only. I even had some students who were trying to call themselves Van Tilian when they were still using traditional arguments for God's existence. Well, you're not Van Tilian then.
Yeah.
But someday we'll go over Clark's thought, Van Til's thought, but whatever the case, so rationalism, so he's saying rationalism works once you have first principles, but you can't get those first principles through reason, so you got to presuppose them, okay? Now he rejected irrationalism, which would be existentialism, postmodernism, anything that throws reason out the window, okay? He rejects it. He says, if we allow contradictions, all thought and communication becomes meaningless, okay? So, you know, I was talking to a postmodernist at the University of Washington, and the guy said to me, well, I was talking to a whole group of them, he said that, now I understand. What you're telling me is, if my postmodernistic views are correct, then I wouldn't even be able to communicate them. If my denial of truth is correct, if my denial of law non-contradiction is correct, then I wouldn't even be able to communicate my views. Oh. And I said, yeah, that's true, but that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is it goes deeper than that. If the law of non-contradiction is false, you wouldn't even be able to think. Okay? So you can't think consistently with your view, which denies the law of non-contradiction, let alone communicate it. So, because even when we think, if you think A, you're saying something. You're saying, you know, if you think A is true, well then that entails that non-A is false. But if the law of non-contradiction gets thrown out, then to say anything is to say everything. And when you say everything, you really say nothing. Yeah. Well, and there's guys who even call themselves that, but that's a whole other story. So basically, he rejects irrationalism. The way his next point: unaided human reason results in skepticism. Hume proved that. Kant proved it. Now Hegel tried to escape it, but even in his escape, he still throws absolute truth out the window.
I've seen that a lot in psychological books. Mm-hmm. The only conclusions, actually, a lot of them, Paul and my brother, when we went to college, we got a bunch of books, and we got the philosophy made simple, and textbooks and math books. Actually, bring it down. The only conclusions you come up with was like a religious, religious philosophy was either skepticism or fideism. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
In most philosophy departments and universities today, faith and reason are viewed as antithetical. There's no such thing as a reasonable faith. From their standpoint, and then that's purely not the case, and it is. But that's just assumed. That's just presupposed, and it goes without argument, and which shows that education, at least in these areas, in philosophy departments, and religion departments today, in many secular schools, there is no education that's going on. It's indoctrination, and so they don't argue that faith is totally separated from reason. They just presuppose it. And that the reasonable... See, I remember you talking about the verification principle was refuted in 1950. We are still suffering from it today. Until some of these old geezers die out, or maybe even young philosophy professors who just aren't up to date, and they're knowing that they were trained by a guy whose philosophy was 75 years outdated, and now his is 75 years outdated too, but there are still guys who still hold to that the Enlightenment argument against miracles, that the laws of nature, natural laws, cannot be, there can be no exception, so miracles are impossible. That is still being proclaimed on college campuses when there is really no leading world class philosopher who would hold to that today. I mean, they may still reject miracles, but on a more probabilistic line, they'd say, well, I haven't seen the evidence for miracles, so I reject miracles, rather than saying miracles cannot happen. You know, so there's a lot of biases, a lot of presuppositions that are untested.
Yeah, and it becomes that, well, then your view is higher than his view, because he says it does, and you say it doesn't, therefore it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their only reason.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your only foundation, then all your truth has to be tested again.
Yeah, and it's just that they come into it with, you know, certain academically correct views that they can't even argue for. They just were indoctrinated in it, now they're indoctrinating you in it. And you're just viewed as this unintelligent.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens, is because, well, now I have this newfound knowledge. I'm smarter than he is because I know the truth.
Yeah.
It's kind of like going back to the sense thing. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, if you close your eyes, you're still able to touch your nose with your hand because, you know, that's your extra sense. Your brain knew where to go. But you wouldn't have been able to compute that unless, of course, you felt it before or seen it before.
Yeah, and I wouldn't call it an extra sense, because...
it's more of a memory created
it's a memory, and a memory is in the realm of the intellect. Yeah, and so that there is more that goes on. If all we had was sense experience alone, I don't even think we could say, you know, point to a tree, rock. Because when you say a tree is a tree, you already have some idea
picture in your mind,
of the universal trees. What trees, you know, so I don't know how much baggage God gave us when he created, but I think there's a lot more.
Yeah, there's a loss of distinction, and that's the big argument there.
Yeah, because just to say when a dog, even a dog, I think, has to use the... the human intellect can think about thinking. We can think about the law of non-contradiction. My dog doesn't think about the law of non-contradiction, but my dog uses it without knowing it. Because when my dog says to herself, my master, when she looks at me, and then when she looks at a stranger, she says, not my master, okay? she's using the law of non-contradiction. But the fact that humans can think about that show that we're on a much higher level than them. But whatever the case, so I don't even think you can have a sense experience without some kind of innate ideas. And that's why Aquinas argued that dogs have souls. Now, he's not saying, but Aquinas argued that dogs have souls not for the purpose of living beyond the life of the physical body. He argued that dogs have souls just to be able to draw, to in the sense experience, to draw rational conclusions that go beyond the sense. So even as an empiricist, Aquinas recognized that even animals have to have some immaterial aspect to them that animates their body, okay, and enables them to draw a certain amount of, you know, rational conclusions from it. Now, obviously, human thinking is on a much higher level, but he would say that they have it just for the purpose. He would call them sentient beings. That they have it just for the purpose of sense experience. Yes, sentient. It sounds like the same word.
Different. I suppose the sentient, like I'm sentient, I can being, I'm conscious of myself.
Rather than being able to feel its existence, therefore it exists.
Because for animals, it's like the dog knows its master.
But I think it goes beyond that,
though. The stimulation of its environment.
I would agree. I think B.F. Skinner's arguments for behaviorism are hitting the nail right in the head if you're talking about a dog. Totally controlled by its genes and its environment. But when you talk about human beings, the whole aspect of human free will comes into the picture. But I do think that as a being that just lives in the world of senses and experience, has sense experience, if you can genetically control a dog and control its environment, you can control the dog. With humans, you can have a certain amount of percentage of control if you control the genes and the environment, but you can't have absolute control because the human beings have free will. Now you could stifle the human free will by doing so much brain damage that a guy can't act. But the fact of the matter is, you can't just program a human like you can program a dog.
Like Coco, that monkey. Man. Where is that thing? Is it in Big Harbor or something? Oh, that monkey's running the car. I don't know if it's still alive.
That's one thing I think both Christian thinkers and non-Christian thinkers have downplayed, and I think Aquinas was on the cutting edge there, but we say intellect, emotions, and will is what makes humans human and shows that we're created in God's image and separates us from the animals. Yeah, human intellect, human emotions, and human will. But you can't tell me a dog doesn't have dog intellect, dog emotions, and dog will. Now, the dog will really doesn't make moral choices being right and wrong.
Nor does the monkey. I mean,
my dog will actually have a guilty look on her face with my dog that died, but she really doesn't feel real guilt.
Sure.
But it's like B.F. Skinner, positive reinforcement, negative reinforcement. My dog looks at me because she knows. She looks guilty, but it really what it is, she knows now I'm going to get whooped because I did what I'm not supposed to do, And the dog has a moment. My dog would cry. My dog would get angry and bark. And my dog, by thinking, okay, my master, this is my master, and that is not my master. So my dog uses like the law of non-contradiction. At the same time, our intellect goes to a much higher level because we can think about thinking. We can think about the law of non-contradiction. My dog can't. My emotions can go to a much higher level. And my will can go because I can actually choose the right thing even though people may be trying to force me or program me to do the wrong thing. And but whatever the case, I think the dimension that really separates us from the dog is the religious dimension. The dimension of man where we seek to worship something, whether it's the true God or a false God or ourselves. And you don't find that with animals. You never find animals burying their dead or in a way that that entails the idea of life after death. And in fact, that's still the way anthropologists distinguish between humans and subhumans. Even that are coming from an evolutionary bent, what they're looking for is that religious element. Even Walter Kaufman refers to man as the God-intoxicated ape. And I would argue, if we're higher than them, then since we're so intoxicated with the God concept, that must be a higher thing, a good thing. Otherwise, Kaufman should argue that the apes are better than us. But he was an atheist, so somehow this big human blunder is the main thing that separates us from the apes, but somehow we're evolved better than them. It doesn't make much sense. But whatever the case, Clark's view was dogmatism, that we should, everybody's got to presuppose something, and if we dogmatically presuppose the existence of the triune God and the truth of the Bible, then it's the only escape from skepticism. And so he would argue that rationalism and empiricism failed to make life meaningful, therefore we should presuppose the truth of Christianity. Only Christianity is self-consistent, gives meaning to life, moral experience. And again, Clark, his whole response to Kant was that God fashioned both the mind and the world so they harmonize. So the gap from reality as it appears to us to reality as it is bridged by God. The way Augustine put it was, he quoted from the Psalms, "In his light we see light." So God not only gives us spiritual light, but just the fact that I know that this is a chair, God is the one that illuminates our minds to know that this is a chair. It doesn't necessarily mean that God is walking with you, and when you look at the chair, God whispers in your ear, "There is a chair." But what it means is, A, God put the intellect, the rational package, the rational categories or preconditions in your mind to recognize a chair as a chair. And B, he's the one who sustains every aspect of your experience, moment by moment, second by second.
Discarding his argument, we know everything is true because as God has revealed it to us, everything else is false until God reveals it to us.
Descartes did reach a point in his thought where he had to deal with the world outside the mind, the physical world, and there is the possibility that maybe an evil demon is deceiving us with the physical world. And Descartes began to argue that God wouldn't do that, God is good.
Yeah,
but that wasn't deduced from his argument. He, like Clark, wanted rational certainty, and he really didn't get it there. Now I would argue that whether we like it or not, we have to presuppose, even Gordon Clark had to presuppose, even though he rejected it in his writings, we have to live life based upon basic reliability of sense perception. Because we will starve to death if we don't. We won't move off the train tracks when we hear a train whistle or see a train coming. So we have to live like sense perception is basically reliable, okay? And if you can't, so to reject the basic reliability of sense perception if you can't live consistently with it, any belief system that you can't live consistent with, it seems to me that's a belief system that ought to be trashed. And that's why Francis Schaeffer's argumentation was so strong, that in the end, we can only live consistently with the Christian worldview. Even those who deny Christianity still live like Christianity is true.
Did Gordon Clark believe, I don't know if when God created man, he created him in an image, but do you hold in the view that God created man with a certain amount of knowledge until he ate from the tree of good and evil, the tree of knowledge, and then when God said, oh, he's become like us now, and that's what we required more knowledge?
I don't know. With Gordon Clark, God did create us with innate packaging. That'd be a good question to ask Aquinas. But we did have an innate ideas and stuff, because he is a rationalist. At the same time, my question for Gordon Clark, the later Gordon Clark, when we could only know for sure what God has revealed in the Bible, what does man presuppose before there was a Bible? You know, basically, Clark, the later Clark's views were... I think the early Clark had some good points, and if he just went from that preformation view and said, hey, since we live in a world, I think you could even argue, since Kantian philosophy leads to skepticism, but nobody can live consistent with skepticism, because the skeptic suspends judgment on all things. But a skeptic doesn't suspend judgment on his skepticism, his suspending judgment. So even a skeptic can't live, and also a skeptic eats food. He isn't skeptical about the food he eats and all. So you can't live consistently with skepticism. If Kantianism leads to skepticism, it can't be true. So we can know reality as it is. But if the statement Hegel pointed out, the statement man can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is, that's self-refuting. Because that's supposed to be a statement about reality as it is. So we can know reality as it is. But that opens the door for just the fact that we reason, says, well, the universe is, we exist in a rational context. It implies a rational cause, a rational ground for the world in which we live. C.S. Lewis argued not only from moral laws to a moral lawgiver, but used the same argumentation for reason with a small r to reason with a big r. That nature cannot cause... reason doesn't come from nature. Nature is non-rational, okay? So there has to be reason with a capital R that brought about reason with a small r.
Or small mover, to a big mover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. C.S. Lewis used a lot of Thomistic type arguments. But basically, what I'm looking at here, by the way, I believe Clark was right that God is logic. You know, in the beginning was the word logos, that's where we get our word logic from. In the beginning was the word was with God, the word was God. Just as God is love, and all love comes from him, and God is good, all goodness comes from him, God is logic, all right thinking comes from him as well. But anyway, Clark, I think he should have seen that only Christianity, where he argues, only Christianity supports the existence of truth and the possibility of knowledge. The possibility of knowing. So in other words, just because humans have the possibility of knowing things doesn't mean we're always going to know the right thing.
Okay. Yeah, but that's still knowledge.
But basically what I'm getting at is we're arguing that truth exists and man can possibly know it. But it isn't a guarantee that man is going to know all truth. And in other words, I know Matthew and John are going to get here tonight, and then they don't show up. Okay, so we can't. So it, basically, by saying that the possibility of human knowledge, the possibility of knowing truth, all we're saying by that is it's also possible for us to think we know something and get it wrong. It doesn't give us omniscience.
Okay.
It gives us knowledge, but not all knowledge, and it also leaves open the possibility of mistake because we're fallible, and all.
If he pieces those in the Bible, like the statement is, we now know we have the knowledge of good and evil. It's still knowledge. May not be all of it, but we still.
Yeah, but what he's saying though is that there are people who say there's no possibility that truth does not exist. And there's no possibility for man to know anything. He's saying that Christianity supports
that, okay.
The existence of truth, the possibility of knowledge. But I would go further.
Different with that, though, because I think man from the very inception had knowledge, because he was able to conceptualize, you know, the difference between right and wrong.
But Clark would just say, yeah, but that's from the Christian worldview, and he would even see the Jewish worldview as apostatizing from the true Jewish worldview, which is now called Christianity. In other words, the scriptural worldview is what he sees as Christianity. So, but whatever the case, the main things I'm getting at is the Kantian dilemma. You had two guys in the 20th century, two great Christian thinkers in the 20th century that said that could be solved by just presupposing that God, rational God, formed the human mind, created man in his image, so that man is rational just as God is rational, and created the universe in a way that makes sense, so that man, through reason, could really find out about the universe in which he lives. In other words, the Kantian wall between reality as it appears to us and reality as it is, is removed if you presuppose the existence of a rational God. Now, I disagree with Clark that it has to be the full-blown triune God of the Bible who's revealed himself in scriptures, but if you just presuppose a rational, personal God, the Kantian dilemma, the wall comes down. Okay? But basically, to simplify this Christian epistemology, this Christian theory of knowledge, the statement absolute truth does not exist is a self-refuting statement. It must be false. Therefore, its contrary has to be true. So in other words, absolute truth must exist. Okay? So truth exists. Absolute truth exists. So somebody might say, well, yeah, but maybe man can know it. But the statement, man cannot know truth, agnosticism, if man knows that, then that's a truth. Then man knows that. Then man knows the truth. So that's self-refuting. So basically, absolute truth must exist and man can know it. It is possible for man to know truth. And so basically that opens the door. That opens the door wide for traditional apologetics. I don't know why Clark didn't see that, but Stuart Hackett was correct. That opens the door wide so that as human beings created in God's image, we can find common ground with non-believers and argue from that common ground to the existence of the God of the Bible, and use historical evidence to argue for the truth of Christianity. So many of the things that Clark rejected, Stuart Hackett, with almost the same starting point, acknowledged. And I would agree with Hackett and disagree with Clark, but basically, on the theory of knowledge, truth and knowledge, it just absolute truth does exist, and man can know it, and that opens the door for us to begin to now look into different apologetic issues. So Now, we're not going to be here next week. The week after, we'll begin to look at arguments for God's existence. I like to use a cumulative case. I think there's at least 14 different good, solid reasons as to why we... I like to argue that, look, it's more in these 12, 13, 14 aspects of human experience, and each one of them, it's more reasonable to be a theist and believe in the existence of a personal God than to be an atheist. And by the way, Michael Martin, Elliot Ratzman, Jeff Lauder, no one has ever taken me up on that. I'm not sure if they even understand what I'm getting at, but my whole thesis, you know, in other words, I'll argue that since science has proven the beginning of the universe, it's more reasonable to believe that a cause of the universe exists, a supernatural cause of the universe exists, than to reject a supernatural cause of the universe. The way they respond to that is there's always the possibility that maybe the universe popped into existence out of nothing, totally without a cause, or maybe science might be mid blah blah. So they're basically looking for tiny, minute possibilities. And that's exactly what I've argued. I've argued that, look, it's what I hold here is very reasonable. And all you can do is run around with little tiny possibilities. I'm not arguing for theism with rational certainty, with logical necessity. I'm saying it's just more reasonable than the contrary. And the fact of the matter is, if we did not make a choice unless we had absolute logical necessity, we would die. We would sit down and look at water and say there's always the possibility that this is poison or contaminated. And we look at our food, there's always the possibility that maybe my friend really doesn't like me and he's trying to poison me and stuff like that. And we wouldn't put clothes on anymore. There's always the possibility that maybe my physical body, the physical world really doesn't exist. So why even put clothes on? Why don't I just walk out naked? And there's always the possibility that people, that everything outside of my mind doesn't really exist.
Yeah,
it's all in my mind.
They're giving names to these objects. They're putting themselves in existence. But yet, every little minute thing that they can think to argue out of existence doesn't exist.
Yeah, and it's kind of like, look, I know that the enduring self, the I, me, I know that I exist beyond reasonable doubt. I don't need logical necessity. I don't need logical necessity about food. I don't need humans, because we're fallible in our knowledge and limited in our knowledge, because we're not all-knowing and not inerrant in all of our knowledge, we have to make our decisions based upon, you know, a high degree of probability or beyond reasonable doubt. And if we just look at the existence of God from that standpoint, we could show that the existence of a personal God is far superior to any of its rivals. So a couple of weeks, that's what we'll be looking at then, in arguments for God's existence. Any questions at all?
The statement, there is absolute truth, is that just the truth or is that a fact?
Well, it all depends on how you define fact.
Unshakable, like you said. See,
some people would define a fact as a rock.
Right,
so some people would define a rock as a fact, but the statement, this is a rock, as a truth. In other words, some people, the word fact has more baggage to it. I kind of see fact and truth as pretty much synonymous.
Okay.
Some people don't. Some philosophers have a more narrow definition of fact, and I'm not even sure exactly what they're getting at.
Well, the truth being something verifiable, whereas a fact was something made.
You don't need argumentation for fact. Like, yeah, the table's here, there's no doubt about it.
Well, the thing is that to say this statement, that this table's here, that is a truth. It's a propositional truth. Gordon Clark would argue all truth is propositional. I think he makes a good case for that, except when it gets to the fact that God is truth. And that we see ultimately truth is personal. In fact, I would say ultimately truth is tri-personal. Okay? But from that tri-personal truth, with a capital T, all truths with small t's come from.
Yeah.
And so I think there's more to truth than just the process.